told her they wouldn't be here.
I like a little humor. And I think one of the funniest things that any of us will ever see is just a quarter of a mile from here, as you go back toward Route 2, and you go down, you go down in the first dip. It wouldn't be but a couple of city blocks from the road out here. If you look on your left, you'll see a mailbox on a high pole. And on the mail, it must be about 15 or 20 feet up in the air, just a regular mailbox, and it says air mail on it. Now this to me, this is real humor. That guy, I don't know who he is, but I'd welcome him in AA. Humor isn't everything, though. I think we need humor. I think it's a sad day when we can't laugh at ourselves. Of course, I'd rather laugh at somebody else, but I think it's a sad day when we can't laugh at ourselves. This is one of the things that we hope to be able to find out how to do this. But humor certainly isn't everything. You know, we're in a dead serious business. This business of staying sober and carrying a message and sharing and getting together and loving. This is AA. And we have a fellow here now who's going to tell us just how this is done. Charlie P. from Roanoke.
Thank you, Jack. I'd like to express my gratitude, that of my wife, Frances, and myself, for the beautiful hospitality that's been shown to us here. It was mentioned earlier this evening about how well it was carried out, and I think it's true. And we thank you so much for having us. It's a real pleasure for us to be here. And I'd like to thank the beautiful speakers here that shared with us for their words and their message. I know my soul is better by being here and being with them. I believe that the last of the formalities that you'll get out of me tonight. My name's Charlie Painter, and I'm an alcoholic. And when I'm this far out of town and this far away from home, I usually start out about the time when General MacArthur and myself had secured the peace for the people of the United States, and I'd made my return to accept the glory. I'll go back and briefly and say that I learned a lot over there in the jungles, mostly about drinking and what to drink and what not to drink, but it wasn't many knots. We usually drank everything. It was liquid and sometimes a lot of stuff that you couldn't even pour. Kickapoo juice and Madine, banana brandy, aqua velva, and right on down the line. And talking about West Virginia being almost heaven. And by the way, I remarked to my wife this afternoon that if West Virginia is almost heaven, then the people here must be almost angels. And I believe it. But by the time I reached back on our beloved shores, I felt like it. I knew all there was about drinking. I was insulted a few times because I got too much aqua velva. You know, we would take it in a steel helmet and pour orange juice in it and just have a real party on Saturday night. Of course, the consequences of it was that you taste soap for the following week. But I came back to take up my position in this small mountain community down not too far from the border of West Virginia. And it was this sweetheart I had there. I told her before I left, you just wait here until I get through over, I'll come back and marry you. And she's waiting around, and I'd been around the world, and you can't live very much in a foxhole and a pup tent, and I didn't get to jitterbug much while I was over there. And get out and club and do these things, and I was a little wild when I got back. So I was trying to slip in a few sideline things there, and in the process I got caught out on a weenie roast with another young lady, and I thought to keep everything quiet, I'd better do something about this, because it seemed like back there in that country, you start going with someone when you're little, they just put the mark on you and think, well, you go on and marry him. Sort of a strange thing. She's a lovely person. And the time came when I had to just go ahead and do that. And I was on gin at that time. I don't know why I was on gin. Probably due to some of my intelligence that I'm going to tell you about a little later. But it was a very... one of the high points there in my days back then is getting my gin in the proper places and having so much for a certain time. But just before the wedding, she asked me if I'd not take anything during the ceremonies. Well, I was taken aback a little bit about that because I didn't think that had anything to do with getting married. And I promised her I would. And me being the pillar of strength that I thought I was, certainly I didn't take any. But we had to go down and talk to this preacher a little while before we got married. And he was giving us that thing that they usually give you, and I didn't want to stand still for it, but I figured it wouldn't last long. And we got out of there and got over there to the church. And went through this ceremony, and at the end of it, he wanted to pray the Lord's Prayer over us and ask us to kneel. Well, I wasn't quite as free, and I was a little uptight, and, well, you might say my knees were locked in place like a sleeping horse. And I had a little difficulty getting down there in that position that they wanted. I did two or three dances there, and finally she got me down there by one arm. And we got out of that thing, and my brother handed me a couple of fists, and, well, from that day on, I reckon that was the beginning of a long road of a lot of things. But I still had this feeling that I was something there in the community, and I never have been able to figure out where it came from, really. Except that I overheard an old gentleman in the community one time say, "Ah, that painter boy's gonna be a fine man one of these days," and that just roared through my mind. And I guess I just lived with it and thought that's what I was and what I was gonna be. And I took a job down there in one of the local plants. It wasn't good enough for me, but I took it and tried to keep up with the social activities that were going on there at the time. By the way, it's a couple of my old friends here, the people that knew me when I was a kid, here tonight from right nearby where I was raised, Hub and Lucille, and they know a little about this. But I couldn't keep up very well, and I had right much mouth, and every now and then when someone was having a little party, a little banquet, they'd say, try to get me to be the master of ceremonies, and I thought, well, I reckon I was probably the best I could get. And at this time, I was taking a little too much in doing some foolish things out at parties and dances, such as jitterbugging and lose your partner and wind up under the table or the booth. I didn't embarrass me because I just took another drink and thought that was part of the show. But on this one occasion, they were having something out there, and they asked me, and I wanted so to perform well. So some old-timer mentioned it about this olive oil business, and I bought a big bottle of olive oil and drank it all after work that evening, and went in and took a few drinks out of mine, and everything seemed to be going well, and we dressed and went out for it. And I was just drinking out of everyone's bottle and dancing, and I just had all my wits about me, and everything was just fine. And when it was over, we went home, and she said, "What a beautiful job you did." And everyone said that, and I thought, well, of course. And then it went on for a while, and they asked me again. Came in a hurry and didn't have any olive oil, and decided I'd eat a half a stick of butter. So I ate this butter and went on, and I was going to do all the things I did before, but somewhere in the middle of the dinner, my head dropped over in the gravy. And I think that she had to have someone to take me home. So I didn't fool with the butter or olive oil anymore. I just continued on to be a drunk. And as little things happened, I began to get the idea that this is a bunch of ungrateful people around here. I'd had this nerve trouble while I'd been over there in the war in a shell shock condition. But no one seemed to appreciate it. I could mention it and they'd walk off. So I didn't like people for not thinking highly of me. Of course, I can see today that was the beginning of the dissension. And as I went on there and working at this place, I got so tired and so sick. And I couldn't make it on these mornings. And a few times I went in, tanked to the gill on the night shift. I remember one time I went in and I was operating a big board. It was operating a big building. And I got a little drowsy and things were a little slow. So I laid my hands down on the desk somewhere along about 1 o'clock in the morning. And somewhere about 7 o'clock, something woke me up and I couldn't do anything. And I was this away and I had to stay this away till I walked about a city block to the clock. And by that time I had hit the corner of the building and tried to get my hands down and got out of it. And it became just a problem for me to work. And so I quit. And before they got rough and caused people to talk. Damn well, he's gotten fired now for being drunk on the job. I didn't want that. And I fiddled around for another job, and then I just got so where I just couldn't make it to work, and this suffering, and I was sort of thin anyhow, and by that time I had two little daughters, and just stayed around the house there. And every chance I'd get, I'd get drunk and make a mess. Get in jail. And I remember the first time I was in that Green Hornet down there. It was so embarrassing for a fellow of my caliber to be in jail. But they opened up a door and in walked this preacher with a mustache. Back in those days, a mustache was a little different than they are today. I love them. I wish I could put up with one. Maybe I'd have one. But he walked in and he was all dressed up and he was sort of a Bo Brummel preacher type fella. Good man, I'm sure. But he sat down there on the bunk and asked me, "Why don't you quit this drinking?" Well, I knew that he was a handsome man and dressed well, but also knew he had false teeth. And I didn't want to add to the jail bill. And I got rid of him, but it was so embarrassing. So as time went on, I became a regular customer down there and still was very embarrassed about it. And the time came when I didn't have enough money to get what I'd been used to drinking, so then I went off to these other things. Just anything that would make me feel different than what I was. I remember on one day I was far into my alcoholism and I was just kicking around the house there, and I had gotten a dose of paregoric from someone, and I don't know about you if you've ever taken any paregoric, but it used to just make my head feel like a rock. Just sit there and look. Know nothing and hear nothing but just float. So I made arrangements to get me several bottles there for the weekend. You know, you had to sign for it back then, and I'd get a couple and get a couple of friends to get me a couple of bottles, and I had a pretty good supply. So I was just as compatible around the house as I could be, and quiet. And my brother came by, and it was a hot day, and he says, "Would you like to go up on the creek, swim it?" And, yes, we'll go. And, of course, I wanted to do what they wanted to do to get along. And I got all my bottles where they were, no one would know about them. And we went up, and I put on my bathing suit, but I wasn't about to do too much swimming to take the edge off of this business because it was going to run out. So I laid around there on the bank, and suddenly on the car radio it came over about this Chinese and this Korean War breaking out. And it thrilled me to death. I happened to be in the reserves for some reason or another. I don't know how that happened, but it occurred to me that here's my chance to get away. I was so lonely in that town, I had passed the stage of walking down Main Street. I slipped around and got in the alleys in different ways. Just wanted to get away so badly. But that perked me up, and that quickened my life. But I remember talking on the way back, "Oh, what a horrible thing this is. We're going to lose so many lives." And just going on about it. And inside of me, I was tickled to death. So went back and started waiting for my papers. And sure enough, it wasn't long till my papers came. And I had about 10 days or 2 weeks. And I was being nice and began to walk back downtown with my papers in my pocket here. For the benefit of anyone that wanted to talk about me, I could maybe give a message to them, let them read it, and say, "Here it is, I'm going back to defend you again." But in a few days there, prior to my leaving, I walked out of the basement one morning and looked through the trees, and the thought occurred to me that, well, in this atmosphere of me leaving, I can probably get a bottle and have just a few drinks and go on away, and no one will ever know about it. So I hollered upstairs, and I said, "Do you need anything from downtown?" And she needed a few things, and I was glad for that because that would give me the opportunity to get a North Carolina suitcase. And if you don't know what that is, that's one of those large grocery bags. And that would lead me down there toward the liquor store, and I could stop in front of the liquor store and look in and start a conversation with one of my old high school friends in there and make it look to these people out here that he'd call me in for further conversation, and I could go in there and buy a fifth. And as luck would have it, I had enough to get a quart of Virginia Gentleman. I was walking in high cotton because I'd been analyzed and was a test pilot for all kinds of chemical companies up to that time. And I got it, and I put it in the bag and walked out and spoke to Mrs. Brown, and I was just as happy as I could be, and went on home and went to the basement and hid it, took her stuff upstairs, and said, "Well, I've got to do some work up here on the third floor. Now, I've got to get this done before I leave here because I don't know when it'll ever be done, so don't do it." So I go downstairs and slip me a big drink. And I get the hammer and screwdriver and the saw and go bouncing up there and beating around on the walls and whistling. And then when it came time again for me to have another drink, I came back down. "Have you seen the flyers?" Right on down to the basement. Got me another drink. and went on back up and went to work. And I don't think she ever said anything to me during these trips down. Don't think she ever answered me. And I believe it was on the third trip down that I got down and I took it up. And I remember I had a smile on my face. And I took a drink. And I set it down. And it came right back out like a fire hose and hit the wall. And I was shocked mentally more than I was physically because I'd never lost anything that early after starting. And I stood around there and stomped my feet a few times and swallowed and took another big drink and hit myself on the chest and went on back upstairs and started to work again. And then the time came for another one. And I went back down and I took another big gulp. And I began to heave. And if heaving were competitive, I would be among the nation's leaders. And if my dear wife will excuse me, and if puking were anything great, then I would be something else too. I began to heave and I began to roar and I got outside the door where all of the community could hear me, and I'm sure they could, because they never missed a trick that old drunken painter boy did. The neighbors, you know, in a small town. And I began to walk, and I began to heave, and I started around the house. And I made several trips around the house, and then this unusual thing, the lower part of my intestines broke loose. And I went into a canter around and around the house. And I thought I was going to die before I could even finish that quarter of Virginia Dental. And there was a picture window in the rear of the house. And on one of the trips around, she was standing there. And I said, get somebody or I'm going to die. And I think she was a little shook up herself. And on one of the following trips around, there stood a doctor in the window. I missed him somewhere going in the front door on the trip around. And he was calling me in, and I stopped my running and ran in there. And he gave me a shot. And it sort of quieted me. And I remember we were sitting there in the den discussing it, and she broke the news. She says, well, I put a bottle of Epicat in his whiskey. She says, but I'll never do that again. And I said, thank you to her. Well, I tried to come out of that. I didn't take any more out of that bottle. Before she told me about the Epicat, I thought it was... I used to hear the old-timers say, don't take the first drink, the first little sip out of the bottle. Either pour it out or give it to someone else because it's poison. And I thought I'd gotten hold of one of those bottles. But after she told me about the Epicat, that settled that. And I laid around that sick, wallowing in her guilt for doing me that away. Tried to straighten myself up. And then went on and reported to Fort Eustis. And I got down there and they started to check me and they checked my pulse. And this man backed off and said, what's the matter with you? My pulse was 134. I says, oh, we had a little celebration before that. I didn't want to get turned down. And they gave me goofballs and things to bring it back up, but didn't phase it. And finally, they sent me back home for 60 days. And I just, you know, I just didn't want to go back and face those people. But I did, and I was determined that on the next round I'd make it. So I went to a doctor, and I said, well, can you give me something for my nerves? And he gave me a bottle of something orange about this high. And just as soon as I smelled it, I knew what it was because I didn't have a degree in pharmacy, but I knew right much about chemicals and tablets. I knew it was full of phenobarbital.
But fortunately, I was able to just take it along. And when I went back through, they had a Navy doctor. And I think he was on phenobarbital or something when he passed me. Because I think when he examined me, I don't think he even saw me. So I was ordered back then to duty as a criminal investigator for the western part of Virginia. And I felt, well, I've finally gotten in the place I ought to be. Whatever this is, it sounds important. And they gave me a gun, and I walked around with a gun on, and gave me all these orders, but I was run down most of the time, and I couldn't read them. But I was very fortunate there, very brave. Because most of the time I was either so rummed down or so drunk that I didn't know how to be afraid. But I thought I was really reaching my star. But still, the hardest task I ever had, particularly in trying to drink and trying to stay sober at the same time, was down there under this old crew-cut colonel that was mean. And when you had to go in to see him, I kept this bottle, this box of garlic powder, and I'd throw it all in my mouth so he couldn't tell I'd been drinking. And one morning he said to me, "I'd rather smell that rot gut lick than I would that old garlic powder." And I was so shocked and taken aback. But what a miserable time. And this is the place that I first found out that there was another world to alcoholism. Of course, I didn't know what alcoholism was, but there was another part of drinking. One day they gave me a notice that there was a big meeting over there, and I had to be there. And I'd been drinking moonshine whiskey and smoking cigars. And I knew I had to get sober for it. So I started walking the streets and not taking a drink. Walking the streets in the hot sun and not taking a drink. Just nervous and sick. And I remember I was making a round trip and coming back to my boarding house. All of a sudden I looked over in this flower garden and three beautiful snakes were crawling down the wall, a beautiful orange and green and black. And I looked at them, and I was near to the porch of where I lived, and my landlady was standing right there. So being the brave man that I always was, I reached over in the flower garden and got a brick and threw it over there to kill the snake. And I missed the snake. And I thought, that's funny, I used to be a baseball player, and missing the snakes is close up. So I picked up another and threw it over, and I missed on that one. And I got mad, and I picked up one and threw it real hard, and it bounced back out in the street and hit an automobile. And she says to me, "Says, what are you doing?" I says, "I'm trying to kill those snakes right there." And she came over and she looked. And she says, "Well, I don't see any snakes over there." And it occurred to me, this is it. This is what the older boys were talking about. And I made a beeline to my mole hole that I had in the basement. And I ran in a little restroom down there and looked in the mirror. And I looked horrible. And I walked out of there and a big brown bear stood right there with his arms open. And I screamed and backed off and took another look, and I found out it was some rugs folded up, standing up there. So I took off out of there, and I remembered a doctor's shingle up there, and I didn't know who he was, but he said he was doctor. And I ran in there right over his patients and everyone. I said, "Give me something here now." And he thought I was crazy. And I had to take my time, and he didn't like it, and finally he gave me something. And from that day, I drank a lot of booze and I took a lot of tablets. But I always drank and took tablets in the fear that there would be snakes or something. And there was something. Armies of ants would attack me. Rubber monkeys would talk to me and throw cups at me in the jail cells. Wild white horses would race through my bedroom. And one time God walked over my bed and knelt down with his long hair and told me that I was a bad boy. And that nearly shocked me out of hallucinations into something else, I'll tell you. But by some fate, you know, these people down there saw that I was... They didn't know what to think of me, really. But they decided that I would probably be a good man over there at Poussin. You know, they had them back down there at the beach. So they ordered me over there, and the old mine started to clicking, and I got my records and took them up, and I said, look here. I've been over there, and I'm shell-shocked, and I got all these things wrong with me. Can you help me? And he says, I can help you. I'll release you. I said, I pray that you release me. I have this family that I have to take care of and all this. And he released me, and money was scarce. I thought I'd save it by hitchhiking back. And so I bought me up a supply, and I got on the road, and it was cold and snowy and icy. And I got up miles, and someone let me out in an open field, and there I stood. And my booze had got down to a couple of drinks, and night came, and I was standing there stomping in the snow. Sometime late that night, a car came by, and he went way on by and stopped and came back and picked me up. And I told him about all these pitiful stories. He wasn't going to be able to take me all the way home. He says, I don't have but one bedroom, but you can sleep in my basement tonight until morning. And I thanked him, and I was glad to sleep in the basement. And I took what I had left there for a long night, a winter's night, sleep. And I slept well, as far as I know. The next morning, I woke up, it was around 7 or 7 o'clock, and I thought I'd just get on out the back door there and not even talk to him. But he caught me and said, I'm sorry for what happened last night, and I didn't know what happened, but the furnace had blown up right there next to me. And, of course, I had all of the coal set on me. And I went on and finally got in home like this. And you'd have thought I'd just been down the street. They didn't want to see me. What are you doing here? But I was determined to make a go of it, and I got a job over there somewhere, and what a hard time I had. I couldn't work at it because I couldn't work. And I started getting in jail again, and finally one day I decided in the cell that there was a Bible that someone had left there, and I looked at that thing, and I said, I need to get something out of this and do better. And I said, where is that psalm that they usually sing or talk about? And I looked for the 23rd psalm, and I memorized it. The idea occurred to me to go to a doctor, see about myself. And I went to a doctor, and I said, can you give me anything that will keep me from drinking? And he said, well, I certainly can. And I can understand his position there. That doctor was wanting to make good in the community. And I reckon he figured if he could do something with this drunk, that he might get a lot more patients. So he gave me a box of tablets and told me how to take them. And I started out slow, the way he told me, and it began to do something for me. And I began to add two. And they did wonders for my mind. I could just remember things and talk and talk. And it gave me courage to go downtown and go in the shops and tell the people of what they needed to know. And I remember I'd been on these pills for about 2 months. Of course, he gave me a phenobarbital at night to kill it so I'd sleep, and everything was working fine. I'd take a phenobarbital and lay down and sleep 9 hours and get up and start the 10 milligram amphetamine all over again and on with my business of getting people straightened out. And on one day there, I had a good supply, and I decided that I'd go to church and try to see if I couldn't get this woman back in order that the people in the community would look up to me. So I got this suit from someplace, I don't know where it was. Went down there, And they were all so glad to see me. My mother was a pillar in the church down there. And I thought then, well, you ought to be glad to see me. You're fortunate to have me down here. And I began to go regularly down at the prayer meetings, and the first thing you know, they called on Brother Painter to pray. And I'd been reading all this literature, and I'd found these prayers, and I'd give them one that I'd gotten out of a magazine or somewhere. And I remember this old lady, good old lady. She says, that was just beautiful. The Lord has a lot for you to do. And I was so embarrassed. I didn't want her saying that to me. I was down there for another reason. I wasn't down there to get any of that. So it went on there, and I got a job selling shoe polish. And they got me a car, and I was driving all over the county, taking these, and the doctor was giving me all I needed. And life was real pleasant. And they had a revival in this church, and I'd figured out everything. I knew it was some of those fellas in there that had seniority on me, but didn't any of them have a mouth I had. So I figured out what night my time would be. They called on laymen in that church to pray for revival. And I figured out Thursday was my night. So I came in from work and got all ready and took me, 10 or 12 more. I think I was taken at the highest day of those amphetamines, 10 milligrams, 37 of them a day. Found out later that was a little bad on my heart. Took it and went on down there, and this ain't did my wife had. I spent many sleepless nights trying to figure out how to kill her and get some of her money at the same time and not go to jail. Never did come up with anything too satisfactory. The poor old thing died just 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we'd made friends long ago. But I didn't like her for many reasons. One of them is she had me put in jail for going to sleep in her front yard. But she said, she called it burning down. I burned down in her front yard. And she had me put in jail. And she called me a drunken reprobate in the grocery store. So I didn't care for her. But she was 3 seats from me that night. And I said, I'm going to give you a good one so you'll take it back to her. And I gave him one of these prayers I'd memorized. And after it was over, everything was all right. And I waited around there 2 or 3 days for the telephone to ring, and I didn't get anything. And I said, well, I'm going to Richmond on business. And whenever I went away, it was on business, I'll tell you that. Always, as one of the other speakers said, I was always where the action was. I went down there, and I'd gotten a little money, and I went to one of my old haunts down there. Some of those smart guys took it away from me that night. I was sitting out in the restaurant there, thinking, you know, what the world was doing to me. Found $2.50 in change in my pocket. They got it all but that. And I was drinking rich broth. I don't know whether you've ever heard of it or not. Come to think of it, it wasn't very good. And the idea occurred to me, here I am in the capital city of this state. I ought to go down here and see the governor and see if I can get some things straightened out. He's no better than I am. Anyhow. So I saved 15 cents and went over and cleaned up and caught the bus down there and had just enough in me, I thought, to be diplomatic. And I walked in there and I asked to see the governor. They looked shocked. I didn't have an appointment and I didn't have anything. But I gave them a few words there of importance, I thought. And they got the milling around and going here and there and coming back out and asking me things. Yeah, that's right. And they called the governor out of a big railroad conference, and he was very gentle and very kind. And I told him about what we thought of his administration up in the western part of the state. I wasn't a member of his party at the time, but I had to do that in order to get where I was going. And we talked a few minutes, and I put a touch on him. And he was very gracious. He says, give the young man a check. And I went, my mind changed over to how great I was. And I wasn't paying any attention. And the secretary says, how much? And I said, well, 50. And as soon as I said it, I knew I could have gotten 500. And here I was with $50, and that wasn't much, but I could get back on it. And I got on back into town. But the experience for my family, my wife, was too great. And she was very decisive in a lot of things. And one time I left on a business trip and she said, "Don't come back." And I thought, "Oh, you don't mean it." And when I came back, she did mean it. And I couldn't get back. So I went back to my mother's, and there I lived. And I say lived. It was low living. But she was the only one that was interested. And it got so where I smoked cigarettes in those days, and she'd give me a few cigarettes. She wouldn't give me a quarter, because a quarter would buy a short one at that time. And if I could get a short one, I could get a long one. So she'd give me a cigarette or two. Trying to stay sober. I couldn't get anything to drink. And one day in the day's mail came a brown envelope from the government. And there was a check in it addressed to me for about $300. Well, here again, my life was quickened because I knew I could get out and move around. And after a little bit, I told my mother, I think I'll go over here on the other side of town and get a room with this girl over there. Good old jolly sort of a girl. I joked with her, and we were sort of friends. I went over, and she says, "Sure." Got settled in my room and had this pocket full of money. Walked uptown, right up Main Street, walked to the drugstore and bought a couple of packs of Camel cigarettes, two or three Western novels. And then I thought, well, while I'm here, I better get me a little something to drink, because I got a room down there and no one will know about it. Go in there and have a few drinks and no one will ever even hear about it. So went in about a fifth and a pint, went on back down, joked with her, going upstairs, started in on that fifth and drank half of it. Laying there smoking cigarettes and reading about some Western Catholic. And I hadn't learned at that time that when you're drunk and about to go to sleep, you hold a cigarette between these fingers. I was holding it between these, because in these they won't give when you go to sleep. I learned that further on down the road. But I had the cigarette in this hand and went to sleep, and it just dropped off. Cigarette just dropped out down there on the bed. And sometime, a little later, I was wakened with this hollering. She was running up through there and said, "Oh, you set my bed on fire." And I thought we were still on a joking basis, and I said, "No, this bed's on fire when I got in it." And I got up and grabbed a glass and going out there to get a little water in the glass and pour it on it. And looked through the window, and there was the fire department and the police department and these ladies wiping their hands on the apron, coming out to see what was going on. So I was barefooted and had on khakis and a t-shirt. So I went through and grabbed a full pint. I don't know to this day why I didn't get it all. But I grabbed the full pint and went out, crossed over on the hill, and sat down in the weeds to watch it. See if it was going to burn or what's going to happen. And the first thing I saw that was the long arm of the law stuck his arm out and poured the rest of my fifth out that window. And I didn't like that. So I got up and skirted the town barefoot and went back home. And they asked me, "What's the matter? Where you been?" And I said, "Not a thing." Never telling anything. Waited around in the midweek paper. I had a paper came out there in the middle of the week. Right in the center of the front page said, "A local man sets bed on fire." That was humiliating. It might as well said, "Charlie painted a drunk down there and burned up Mrs. so-and-so's bed." And I had to get out of town again for a few weeks to get over it. And I went down to the Capitol again and got
Some fella started picking on me there at the railroad station. I had my ticket, and I had my booze, and I just had lunch waiting for the train ride back. And he came up and wanted to take me down to the police station, and I thought, well, you know, this is fun. What are you going to take me to the police station for? Luck would have it, a police officer passed by, recognized me when I used to be there. What are you doing in there? I said, I'm dying. Do something for me. Well, he went immediately and got a car and took me to the medical college. And if any of you have been in Richmond, and I'm sure you have, the medical college is real high. And he took me up on the last floor and took me in there with an intern. And he knew what the score was. And I told him, he says, what do you take for this? I says, a good big shot of formaldehyde will do anything, do better than anything. So he pulled me out one. And I says, while you're doing that, may I use your telephone? And he says, certainly. And I picked up the book, and I found the president of the Baptist World Alliance, his number. And it was long, somewhere in the middle of the night. And I called him up and told him what they were doing to me down there. And he was just as gracious as he could be. He says, well, I'll have someone to come down there and get you out in the morning. And he did. And that man got me out, and the judge there asked me a few questions. This man was standing. I thought I was going to the penitentiary because this man looked like he needed to be in bed. And I said, well, he's going to put that against me. But he didn't. He let me out because his preacher was standing there. And I'm still thankful to that preacher. And I got out of there, and I had the little money they'd given me, and went on the road again. These trips from Richmond back, I don't remember too much about them, you know. Every other day, you know, you might remember a barn you slept in last night and, you know, get up and go get a bottle of wine or something and a tomato and a package of nails. And then wake up the next morning and look around and you can see what you digested, you know. Tomato and peanut butter and nabs all mixed up in a pile. On this particular occasion, I got back in near home and it was near a vegetable stand and I saw these cucumbers over there. And suddenly I had a tremendous compulsion to swallow one of those cucumbers whole. And I went over and I got one and I ate it and it was huge. Oh, it tastes so good and it wasn't far to the house. By this time it farmed me out to an old lady, a friend of the family that lived in a 12 or 17 room house and put me up on the top floor to see there to protect her. And I got back in there and put a sign on the door, please do not disturb. And I thought I was going to die and they broke in there and asked me what was the matter with me. And I says, I ate a cucumber out here on the road and it's giving me acute indigestion. And I believed that because then I didn't believe it was being 2 weeks on the road and eating a tomato and a package of nabs that had anything to do with my indigestion. But I still tried to defend myself and I kept up a defense. And I remember one Sunday morning, and I never had anything to drink on Sunday morning. I couldn't even find a drink of Listerine. I woke up and I was about to die and I knew I had to get someplace. And on Sunday morning in this town, the streets were still bare. And I walked up and I think people were beginning to come to Sunday school and I resent them for putting on an act. Yeah, what are you all dressed up? What are you going for? Going up there laughing and talking, you're trying to kid someone, you know. I didn't believe in it. But after a little while, I spotted a stranger down there, and I believe that man was from Charleston, West Virginia. I'm not sure. He was dressed up. And I moseyed on down to him, and I don't know who spoke first, but we got in a conversation, and suddenly he says, "Where could a man get a drink around here?" And I suddenly got well. Because I knew if that man wanted a drink and he was talking to me, that I was going to get half of it if we just got one. "Oh, yeah, I can get you right up the street here. I can get take care of that. Come on, let's walk up there." We walked up there, and he bought 2 fifths. And we had a big drink there. On the way back, he says, "Where can we go to drink? Any place to swim around here?" And I said, "Sure. I know a place out here in the country, not very far, secluded." So we got a taxi cab, and we went out in the country there to the Blue Hole. And we drank, and we talked, and of course, you know, when you're doing this kind of talking, I didn't hear what he said. I didn't know where he was from, because I had to get mine planned, what I was telling him, so he'd think I was a great guy, just having this down on my luck. He went in swimming, but I wasn't going to take any edge off of that by going in swimming. Maybe I went in once. Came back out and laid down, and somewhere during the thing I went to sleep. And the cool of the evening breeze awakened me. See, we didn't have on any bathing suits. We didn't have any. We didn't need any out there. And I awakened, and it was seemed sort of cool. And I looked around, and I didn't see this fella. And I thought maybe he stepped out in the woods. And I hollered, "Hey!" Didn't know his name. Hollered several times. And looked around, and there wasn't any bottle there. And then I discovered that it wasn't any clothes there either. And I had mixed emotions about this, you know. What's he doing? Is he kidding me? Is he out there in the woods hiding with my clothes and the whiskey? Or what is it? And I stomped around now on the bank a while, and finally, it was getting late, and I couldn't see him, and I couldn't find him, and I started weaving on up through the bushes there to an old fisherman up on the river, that creek there. Just sick and hot, had a temperature. And I remember I got up there pretty close, and I reached down, and I got me one of these big Murdoch leaves. I guess they grow up here, too. And I held it in front of me, and I got behind this big tree. And I hollered out there for him, and finally he came out looking all around. I said, "Hey, over here." And he came over there, and I stepped out behind that tree with this Murdoch leaf, and he did a backflip. Oh, he laughed, and he laughed, and I thought he'd never get through so I could get to what I wanted to do. Ha, ha, ha. Finally, he got me in there and gave me a pair of tennis shoes and overalls. And I suffered my way back to town, dodging in and out and wondering, you know, who's going to be the first one to break the news. "Well, he left you naked out there on the river yesterday. Ha ha." I didn't want anyone to say anything about me. From that to anything that you want to mention, to the state houses, not to the penitentiary, but to the place for the mentally insane, they wouldn't put me in a place where they gave you drinks to taper off. My mother said, during the conferences that they had there about me, they'd say, "Let's put him in this place." And she'd say, "I understand they give him something to drink over there. And no, he's not going in there. If it's one thing that boy needs, it's not another drink." And I thought, well, she's old-timey, and she don't understand. I didn't like it. I'd like to go on over there. But no, she sent me to the hard places, and
And I had a brother-in-law there that was Commonwealth Attorney of the county. And at that time, I thought he was right idiotic. Some of these escapades that I would have, he'd laugh in the barbershop and say, I had a nickname of Beetle. And it went from Beetle to Peetle to all just anything that you want to call it. And he'd laugh and say, old Beetle went down and put it on the governor. And I wanted to get it. And I remember one time I walked up to his house, the conference, the family conference was being held at his home that night. And I'd been drunk for about 3 weeks. And I slipped up like a detective, looked in the window, saw who all was there, and decided that I'd break that one up. Walked in the front door, and he was holding forth, walking backwards and forth, telling them what the score was about me, and where they ought to put me for 6 months or 8 months, something. And he had a fireplace over there in the end of the place. And I just gave him a little tap. And he went on in his own fireplace. Of course, we had a time there for a while. But he didn't care for me at all. And there wasn't any love lost. We call it resentment in AA, with a passion I had it for him. One time, his wife, my sister, I'd been out in Tennessee on business and got mixed up out there some way. That liquor that I was drinking was not the kind of liquor that I'd been used to, and it did something to my head, and I had about 9 rooms rented in the city of Johnson City. It was all messed up. Well, finally, I walked out of Johnson City barefooted, and some old fella in Tennessee gave me a pair of shoes about this long. And I walked out down the road, and a fella came along on a motorcycle. And I was filming, and he stopped. And I never have been much of a motorcycle fan. Of course, they're very popular today, and I say everyone to their own kick. But I needed to get on back in, and I got on the back of that motorcycle, and the wind in my face and the fear in my heart, he carried me about 30 miles, and when he stopped, he told me to get off, and I said, you're going to have to undo my hands here. I'm locked. And truly, the muscles had locked, and I couldn't get off, and I was sober, but felt a little fluffy. But I made it on back, and my sister put me in the basement there for, to get me sober, locked the door down there in the rec room. Might as well have been in jail. And I walked the floors, and I walked the floors, and I thought about breaking out the windows. And I happened to walk off into another room, and up there was this bottles, looked like some paint cans. Whiskey bottles looked like had turpentine in them. But somewhere, I spotted one that looked like it had seal on it. And I got it down, and sure enough, it was. And she was bringing me down some nerve pills ever so often, and a little custard. And I was drinking that booze, and when I'd hear her come down the steps, I'd lay down on the couch, oh, me, and take that old pill. And I was a professional at taking a pill. I remember distinctively one time on the street that it was time for me to take an amphetamine. So I just picked it out of my pocket and threw it up there and caught it in my mouth. No one ever saw it. So I was throwing her pills out and drinking the whiskey, and I stayed down there for several days. And after the whiskey was gone, I found a case of beer in there. And I always thought that was a big deal when I'd be talking to other drunks, maybe under the bridge somewhere, with a little canned heat. And I'd tell about that, how lucky I was. Now, through all of this mess and through all of this destruction, I didn't know it, but there was a power. There was a power greater than myself. And I know it tonight. Saved me from death and destruction and led me, directed me, and allowed the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to find me. And I didn't want to go because I was this he-man with intelligence. And it's so embarrassing to me now to talk about my intelligence then. But he aimed to do something with me. And he held me there. And the first night, I shall never forget it, I walked in there, and this lawyer that I'd known when I was a child, he was standing up there talking about stealing and what he'd done, all this and that, and I was back there. And I said, I'm going to be in jail for this. They're going to come in here and get him for telling this stuff and get me for being a party to it. I had weird feelings about this AA because I didn't know anything about it being from the mountains up there. But after it is over, they came up to me with neckties on and they shook hands with me. And one fellow told me, you can be anything you want to be. And there were some powerful people, seemed to me, there then. And they worked with me, and they worked with me, but I was so full of stubbornness and egotism that I'd work a while, and I'd just get drunk. And I got drunk 3 times after I came into AA. I remember I was working there a while, and I was doing real good, and I had 3 months sobriety, and this 2 or 3 people younger than myself. One of the directors called up and told me to go see this man down there and take one of these newer men with me. And I took him down there and I said, now you pay attention. And I got in there and the room was cold. And it reminds me of this picture we see in AA, this poor drunk sitting on the side of the bed. And I walked the floor and I preached and I talked to him. And every time I turned my head, he knew how to take pills too. And this new man sitting over there just watching me. And I felt like I'd done reached it all in. But next morning it was quite a shock. Found out this man died during the night. Wanted me to be a pallbearer. That took me down a little bit, but it didn't completely straighten me out. One time I got 9 months and I'd been elected to the steering committee. And I'd been placed on the board of directors of the Easy Does It Club. And, you know, some of you here know about the Easy Does It Club. It's one of those funny things in AA. And I walked around, and I remember I couldn't get down very far because I was full up the ear of AA. And it occurred to me that I ought to go to the Pentagon and see a general friend of mine up there and get some things straightened out. And I did. And I walked in and told him I wanted to see the general and said, who are you? And finally, I got to see him, and he was all glad to see me, and asked me, can you still cut that hard liquor like you used to? And I didn't want to soften up in front of him, and I said, no, not quite as bad. And he said, well, let's go get one down at the lounge. And we went down and had two somethings with red in it, and I wanted to get away. And I got drunk. And that was the last time. I remember somewhere in Washington, I was so sick, I moved 3 different hotels. And the last thing I remember was carrying a belt and an old yellow shirt down the street, and it was so heavy for me, I just took it in the alley and laid it on an old oil drum. But I got back. And I said, there's some people staying sober here, and I want to know what it is, and I wonder what they're doing. And I started praying in the morning, and praying in the evening, and praying as I walked down the street. And somehow or other, I came to believe that praying was the thing that gets this contact that we talk about here. I prayed then, and I haven't quit praying a whole lot. I just pray anywhere, anytime, and I talk about God a lot, and I haven't tonight because well, I don't know what his message for me today is. But I depend on him, and I've come to know him, and these things that they told me, says, you love those people, now you're resenting. And I couldn't buy it. But I kept trying, and finally one day, I saw someone that I resented, and, you know, he had on a red shirt, and he was putting on airs, and I went, what are you doing in here acting smart? And I caught myself resenting him, and suddenly I found out, you know, Lord, you know, you made him just like you did me and bless him.
things began to get better. And I realized that my life had gone back from this brilliant young boy. I had gone from sugar to ecstasy, whatever they're using up there now. That I made a mess out of it, and that I had a disease, and it was called alcoholism. And prayed more, and God began to hear me more, and I began to get better and feel better. And I felt better in my gizzard and in my heart and in my stomach, and I didn't have pain shooting in here. You see, I always thought I was going to get a heart attack. I didn't want to die. A lot of drunks want to kill themselves, but I was just a little different. And the tension settled. And one beautiful day, and I don't know what day it was declared and given to my soul and to my mind and to my heart, the idea that you don't want a drink, you don't have a desire for a drink today, and you don't ever have to drink again. And I began to know something of this love. I began to hear people talking. I began to watch them in their activities. And I began to believe, yes, there is a love different from that that I saw. And this God, who I am in the palm of His hand 24 hours a day, I must talk to Him. I must spend more than a few minutes in the morning and a few minutes in the evening, because after all, I hang suspended and I'm in His care. The idea occurred to me, if I can talk to my wife or my friend for an hour, I can give more time to Him, and He can give me more direction. Oh yes, this is a spiritual program. This is the Omega of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's no way I could tell you about being crazy and being in jail. And lying and stealing, that I could stay sober on that alone. These steps right here, four times they speak directly of God, four times indirectly, and four times of high morality. Sometimes I've been called a preacher. That's all right. I'm not going to ever be a preacher. But I'm going to always, and I hope and I pray for this, that the God of my understanding, the Spirit that's here tonight, will always keep me in this vein, because without it I can't live. I can't breathe. I depend on the Spirit, your Spirit. And there is a spirit here tonight that's probably not in many places in this state of West Virginia. Not because Jolly Painter's here doing the mouthing, but because we have come here together. And I doubt seriously if there's anyone in here that had the idea when you came up tonight that we're going to plan to rob the bank down here in Parkersburg. Or that there's somebody down there that we're going to take out and lynch. You see, we didn't come here with that in our mind. We came here with something good in our mind. Maybe not the thought of staying sober today, because we, you know, but something good to share in the love and joy of the fellowship. So then if this is true, and if history is true, then where we gather together, even two of us, in the spirit of goodness, then the power of God is there too. You have blessed me by allowing me to be here. Spending your time and allowing me to free my soul once again. I shall be larger in my heart and my soul for this trip to Parkersburg in the land that's close to heaven. I look forward to Big John tomorrow, because I know he's got it for us. And the reason I know it, he's got that living experience. You know, they used to say back in the old days, the one that got up earliest this morning, the soberest today. Well, somewhere along the line, I sort of let that one go by. because I don't believe that's possible. I look forward on Sunday tomorrow when we leave away from here and depart for the spirit and the goodness and the refreshing thought that I'll take. It's my prayer that God in a special way will bless your heart. Let your mind know one thing new for this day.